I came to the conclusion the other day that appendicitis is the white dog shit of internal organ and surgical related procedures. Because when I was a kid, it's all you fucking hear about. So-and-so is in the hospital for appendicitis. Kids at school all the time offer appendicitis. To the point where when I was a kid, the idea that you would have to have it out was considered inevitable. That's how it was presented. Yeah. In the media, it was presented and colloquially, and everything I heard as a kid. But it's like ram raiding. It's petered out. You don't hear about it so much when before it was an epidemic. And again, as I point to the white dog shit, which was a change in dietary thing when regulations came in. For those wondering why white dog shit disappeared.
Can't say I've ever wondered, but I am intrigued now that I know.
Well, yeah, you know, it used to be one of life's great mysteries. As a kid, you'd go to the park and you'd see sun-baked dog shit and it had been baked white. And then one day, I say one day, I don't know if it was over the course. At some point, you stop looking. You stop hanging around in the park poking at dog shit with a stick. We were a very poor family. We made best with what we could do. And then one day, you know, you just notice it's not there.
And you just didn't know what you had, right?
You really don't. White dog shit, the fear of an organ exploding inside you. Some people call that a fear. I call it an opportunity.
Hey-o.
Thank you.
That's a Friday night.
I'd throw on that list not getting so many bugs on the windscreen of the car anymore.
I mean, that one's depressing. That's our environment killing them all.
I mean, I'm sure there's reasons for all of them. Yeah.
Yeah, although that may account for the lack of ram raiding these days. Maybe half of the ram raids were just people with windscreens full of bugs. So, you know, silver linings, I guess, which many of the clouds have now because of the pollution. And that's the end, by the way, of my topical, some might say a sideways look at current events.
Just a little kooky way of thinking of things.
Yeah. Although I did look it up. Apparently appendicitis has been on the decline since the 1940s. So. Oh.
So this is just like crime rates.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm glad to hear it's actually on the way down, because my assumption was it hadn't gone down. It's just it only, like, if it doesn't happen to you as a kid, it's probably never going to happen. And that you just aged out of being around the ones having their appendixes explode.
Now, you see, I always thought of it as a thing that happened more in adulthood, but maybe that was wrong. I don't know.
According to, I've been obviously looking into this, because I thought that if I did this, I would find out why exactly white dog shit had disappeared. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all connected, I assume. Join the dots, sheeple. But yes, there is an age range. And it does start at, I forget the exact age range, but it sort of peters out about 30. Mm. 10 to 30, that's it. Like, pretty wide. Mm-hmm. But I'm fucking well aged out of it now. But yeah, there is this sort of big window that spans childhood and adulthood and then sort of disappears. I mean, I've never had appendicitis. I've had the old gallbladder slurped out of me. But appendix is still in there doing whatever it is they do.
The way they talked about appendicitis growing up, it sounded like everyone's got a little ticking time bomb in them. Why don't you just take them all out at the start? Like, wait until they're born, day one, take the thing out, don't risk it exploding.
Maybe it was a scam by Big Appendectomy. Maybe that's what it is.
Like, I thought that there was concern. Like, it's one of those things, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, right? I think there was
a reason. That's just the vision I had of it as a kid, was like, why would you leave the bomb inside of me?
Yeah.
You know it's there to go in and defuse the bomb.
That was the attitude back then. I grew up the same way. I mean, The Simpsons didn't help, where they had one thrown and it blew up, like, literally like a bomb.
You know, I think that really just speaks towards the surgery culture that we now experience with, you know, the rise of plastic surgery and all of that normalization.
Isn't it, though?
Of basic procedures. Yeah.
Isn't it, though? Breasts exposed for our pleasure. Mm-hmm. Cats and dogs fucking in an alleyway. while a sheep watches. What the sheep's doing in the city, nobody knows, but that's where society's at now. Literally gone to the dogs with your legs spread, meowing.
Welcome to Pogquisition. We talk about video games here sometimes. We've played a few of them, I think.
This nonsense.
Yeah. I've played one this
lobsters
week.
Lobsters in the traffic, Laura. Lobsters in the traffic. Just among the cars, Laura.
Funny you mention lobsters, because they're not that dissimilar from crabs, and I was about to start talking about a game that involves a crab we've both played.
We've both played a game involving many crabs.
Yeah.
And lobsters.
Have you finished the game with the crab?
No, I'm on the cusp of the end, so I want to wrap it up and get my review written at the time of talking today, so it can go up at the time of talking tomorrow.
Yeah.
Yes, another crab's treasure, a Souls-like game about gentrification.
Yeah, it is about gentrification.
Under the ocean.
It is a game where you're a little adorable crab in a colourful world, facing the evils of, you know, turning a blind eye to oppression across the world because it's easier to retreat into your cosy little home, and pollution, and environmentalism, and all the such things that you would expect out of a game about a little crab.
Yeah, yeah. The writing is lovely.
It's charming.
I really do like all the little political sort of humour that's in it.
Mm.
I like the protagonist, the crab. There was a great line I saw today while playing. One character was teaching him like a special ability and mentioned how it was like, you've got to think like a spiral. And then he was like, oh no, that's great. I spiral all the time. I'm brilliant at it. just those little sort of...
Yeah.
Goofs about mental health that you don't see outside of that kind of indie game that I always appreciate. Yeah, yeah, that's very charming. Now, how it is as a game, I like it, but there are issues.
I feel, I think, a little more positive on the gameplay than you, but I think one thing we were able to agree on is it definitely doesn't shine mechanically at its best at the start. It gets better as it goes, but it starts a little shaky.
I mean, it certainly gets more fun. I would say that in some of the later areas, I found it a bit jankier. And that's really my main issue with it, is it's a very janky Souls-like.
It's a very indie Souls-like, yeah. And there is some jank that comes with it.
And the issue with that is this is a genre where being able to rely on responsive controls and a character doing what you want it to do, jank is a lot more noticeable in a game like this.
Yeah, and I will say, like, I will dig into the accessibility stuff in quite some depth, I'm sure, but the accessibility stuff being there, as well as just generally being positive, I found was helpful for papering over a couple of little areas of some of the jank.
Oh, I did not feel guilty at quite a few points putting on that accessibility feature that just straps a gun to your back.
Yeah, well... Yeah, yeah, we'll get to the gun. So to, like, give a sense of, like, how this lines up with other Soulsy games, it's definitely a bit shorter than a lot of other Soulsy things you'll play. Like, I think my first playthrough of this was around 20 hours, maybe? Which, the narrative supports that kind of game length, and particularly given some of the mechanical reductions compared to, like, a Dark Souls, I think it's probably for the best. You don't have different weapons to select from. You have your one weapon, which is your little fork. And there are things you can do to change the loadout for, like, your offensive loadout. There is a power-up that lets you stick things on the end of your fork to turn it into basically, like, a slow warhammer. You've got various shells you collect that are defensive options, but they also come with an associated little magic spell that gives you an offensive option. But this isn't a game about building out, like, your big... unique to you build so much. Additionally, there is, like, there's a couple of little changes. Like, there isn't a stamina meter for you in combat. You don't have to worry about stamina. You mainly have to worry about things like, if you are spamming dodge, it seems like you get less invincibility frames the more you spam it, things like that. I think those are the biggest mechanical changes. There's also the existence of a sort of little grappling hook thing that is usually used for traversal, but does later eventually get some mechanical uses. There's not a lot of specking into a different kind of combat build.
No, I mean, there aren't builds. Like, there really aren't. Yeah, there's freedom to allocate the stats how you wish, and I wouldn't even say the abilities you have are part of a loadout because they're transient. Like, it's no more part of a loadout than the weapons in Zelda are.
I would disagree slightly with that, and only because of the existence of the insurance mechanic, which is, if you find a shell that you like that has a ability that you quite enjoy using, for me that was the lid of a sriracha bottle, that lets you sort of spin on your back and do melee damage. You can basically pay to go, anytime I die and respawn, I respawn with that shell on from the start. And it gives a bit of consistency to, I like this being a regular part of my loadout. Yeah. It'll always be there available, like when I restart a boss fight, for example. But you are right, like, outside of having, I want this to be regularly available, it is by nature fairly transient, your access to what your loadout's going to be.
It really comes down to, like, how much control you have over a character, and I think it would vary from person to person how much they would consider it a build versus just having a gun in a shooter that you just pick up, like, in a level. Like you don't necessarily have a loadout in Doom versus something like Dark Souls, where there are so many weapons and so many different skills and classes to move into.
Yes.
You can argue that on a very basic level, you can have builds, but I think the way many people, especially in this genre, would understand what a build is, I'm agreeing with you, like you say, where it's not a big buildy thing.
Yeah, it's not a game about, I'm going to really specialize, this is every piece of armor I've got. Like, you do have a weight system that affects your dodge roll, but it's purely based on, did you pick a heavy, medium, or light shell to use? It's a lot of the core fundamentals, but sort of paired back in the number of systems you need to be thinking about.
Oh yeah, I mean, if you play this game, everyone's playing it more or less the same way, basically. Yeah. Same moveset, same thing. Yeah, and it's a shallow pool, dare one say.
It's mainly, do you want to be using the fork for light, quick attacks, or do you want to be using the Warhammer? That's basically your only real conceptual choice about battle.
Yeah, so very much a very smaller scale, stripped back Souls-like, which is not a bad thing. You know, a more straightforward, simplified version is, honestly, what the genre could do with, rather than more fiddly ones that people have got to throw hours and hours and hours into, because Lord knows we've got Elden Ring for that. We've got so many games for that these breezier Souls-likes, I certainly think, are quite welcome. But yeah, my only real issue with it is the messiness of it can really get in the way. Like, I'll lock on and the amount of times the camera will go behind scenery or like in a mountain or something, like in a cliffside, and then I can't see. Unresponsive dodging at times, like I don't feel like I can rely too much on it. I've gone through the floor on stuff. It's not an unplayable shit show. I would say it's jankier than the average Euro jank you get from, like, Focus Home Interactive.
I had less of an experience of that. I didn't come across as many janky moments as you in it. My two things that I think were, like, an issue for me, and I think they're fairly fixable things, but they were little barriers. There is an area of this game that I fundamentally am frustrated with, that is without going into too many specifics, a visually very dark area of this game. It's very easy to miss that there are light sources that can be activated because it's too fucking dark to see that they exist. And it dovetails with my other problem about this game, which is that the map cannot be zoomed out or moved around on the pause screen. You have to physically walk around and then open the map of the pause screen and move to the map screen again to see new bits of this kind of vague representation map, which can get really frustrating if you get lost in an area such as this very dark area where the map only shows you a tiny little bit of visibility. It was my one point where I stopped enjoying the game briefly, and I think it's a very fixable thing. I think it's, like, something that could be addressed, but There is one area in this game that I'm like, once this game is out, go, if you get stuck in the very dark area, look up a fucking walkthrough, because it's a bit irritating. But generally speaking, I really enjoyed my time with it. I think that, like, the plot was really, really solid. It did a really good job of setting up an expectation of a very light-hearted, sort of gentle spoof of the genre. And it grew into something with something pretty decent to say that was tied into its mechanical themes, that gave its character a pretty satisfying arc from where they started to where they ended up. I enjoyed the humor a lot. I liked a lot of the world-building stuff, and particularly, I think this game is a really fucking good example of the fact that you can have accessibility settings and difficulty tweaking settings in a Souls-like, and it doesn't fundamentally prevent that game from having themes of challenge and struggle and overcoming adversity, and have it still work.
You don't have to toggle the gun on.
Yeah, you don't have to.
You can, and it's great.
It's so fucking good toggling the gun on. I love the gun.
So the gun, and again, it's in the options. You can toggle it on at any time, and you do not have to keep it on. You do not have to ever put it on. But one of the quote-unquote shells you can put on through the accessibility menu is a gun that will lock onto things from a ridiculously long way away and mm-hmm. one-shot them, from the smallest enemy to the toughest boss. And mm-hmm. it's there, and it doesn't fuck the game up. The only way it would fuck a game up for you is if you don't want to use it and you use it for some reason.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm all for it, especially because some of the enemy placement in that game borders on fucking trolling. And I really don't mind popping off some bullets to get over the bits where they've, like, given this really small ledge that's only really got room for one on it and an enemy's on it. Or jumping, like, platforming areas, and the platforming's already its own thing, full of fucking projectile enemies. Like, sometimes I'm just like, you fucking troll, and that's when I strap a gun to my back.
Occasionally you have that moment where it's like, I dropped way more microplastics than I should have dropped, and I just can't be arsed with losing them right now. I'm going to spend about 45 seconds on a gun-wielding rampage with this gun that's about 30 times larger than my tiny little crab, and it'll be very fun, and then I'll get my microplastics back and go, that was fun, put the gun away, or stick the gun on the end of your fork as a melee attachment,
yes,
and wield the biggest fucking melee weapon in the game, and it's great.
The shells are fun. Like, we should talk about the actual,
yeah,
the intended in-game shells.
Yes.
So it's all detritus, like a big part of the game sort of focuses on the amount of trash that's in the ocean, and, you know, the sentient creatures are kind of doing their best to use it for stuff. So
yeah,
a lot of what you put on is garbage. And it, each one has its own special ability, and like you said, Laura, different weight class and different durability. So it could be like a bottle cap, which you can pop in and then pop out of to mm-hmm. sort of do a you know, more damaging attack.
Sushi that you can eat part of and use it as an extra healing item.
Yeah, you can have food-based shells
that
you can consume.
There's the fizzy drink can that puts bubbles in the air that auto-target if an enemy gets close enough to them.
Yeah, that one's cute. There's a dead crab, which is my favourite one. Which you can, like, pop off as a decoy. There's also an Among Us one that does that. Like, some of the joke shells are also cute.
Yeah. My favourite one, like, in terms of just a thing that activated my brain, is the Yakult bottle. Sticking that on the end of my fork as a hammer brought me so much weird joy.
Yeah. There's a lot of, like, fun ideas. You could tell they've had a good laugh, like, thinking, what can we put on this character's back, and what could it do? I like the ones that give buffs, like the putting the coffee cup on and then getting a sort of caffeine jolt to attack faster, stuff like that.
Yeah,
that experimenting with them is quite fun. I like that. And I do like that it has gone out of its way to give you ways of keeping the shell.
Yeah.
Not only is there an accessibility option to up the durability of them, which I put on because I, you know, me and my opinions on durability. I don't find it all that fun. So I'm like, fuck it, I'll pop that on. There is the shell insurance. So if you have a favorite one, you can keep it, which is one of my biggest bugbears with things like this. And it's great that it's here. And there's like skill trees. And on one of the skill trees, there's an option to basically repair the shell once after it breaks, and also repair its durability when you go to a rest point. So it gives you... I'm at a point now where the dead crap, because I'm so delighted by it. It wobbles. Like, it's got the physics. Its poor little legs are just wibbling. But I never not have it now.
I like the thing as well that, like, when you do boss battles, that shell insurance will pick, it will kick off so that you can restart the boss fight with your, you know, preferred shell. But also, I like that the boss arenas are littered with very specific shells that are, like, clearly some thought has gone into, particularly with the later ones, providing you tools that they think will be a fun mix for this boss fight. And without getting into too many specifics, there is a fight involving, you know, somewhere where you might expect a ball to be bouncing around, where there are balls you can use as a shell to sort of, like, fire yourself very fast across that arena. It was, like, a nice little thematic use of some junk to have. And I think there's, like, a good degree of that, like, as you get far enough in that you've seen a good variety of shells, that they make, like... Here's one thing, like, there's clearly a bit of trash we've designed because we think it'll be good for this fight, but there's also five or six other popular options if you want to try some things that might work for you in this fight. And, like, I appreciate having that stuff littered around in the boss arena.
Oh, yeah, I mean, some real thought was put into it. And of the games that do this, of the games that have featured durability with equipment, this might be the best one. This might be the best balanced one I've seen. And part of it is fundamentally the shells. Look, you've always got your offensive weapon, and because the shells are more defensive, that tempers it some. So I'm certainly myself less like fucked off with it because it's more like armor, which is sort of a resource that I don't mind managing as much. But then on top of that, like you say, they put thought into, okay, well, if this shell breaks, if they come here without one, what have we got here? And how will that fit into the boss fight?
Yeah.
And then, of course, all the different ways of keeping a shell longer that I mentioned earlier. That level of thought put into it, like, if we're going to do this durability, how do we make that as fun as possible and as tolerable for as many people as possible? Yeah. If it's got to be in a game, do it that way. Definitely do it that way.
Yeah. A couple of other things I like about this that I think are worth noting with this game. Because it's set underwater, I love that you have the ability to hold down the jump button to sort of kick your legs and swim in the air a bit. Makes me so much more willing to do platforming and verticality in a Souls kind of game, because you've got that little bit of extra wiggle room to play with. And particularly when paired with the sort of grappling hook mechanic, I like that there is a decent amount of verticality in these environments. It's not something you see a lot of in the genre, and it helped set this apart a little.
Definitely, definitely. And it works. For as janky a time as I've had, for the most part, the platforming is actually pretty good. Largely as a result of that floating, that ability to float about, as generous as it is. Like, it's not indefinite. There is a bit of a stamina thing attached to it, but it's enough to where you can make some pretty good jumps, and if you are off a bit, you can course correct.
Yeah.
Which I really like. And for some reason, I'm not sure how they've done it, but I find immense satisfaction from moving on the netting. When the crab moves, you know, it's like how you'd use a net or vines in another game, you just climb up a wall. But he's a crab and scuttles, so it's not like slower than walking on the ground.
Yeah.
It might even be a little faster than at least the walking speed on the ground. But there's just there's a smoothness to it that I did not expect from this game, that when I latch onto netting and I'm walking around on the wall, I'm like, this feel, I don't know what they've done, but it feels really good, even though I'm just moving the stick.
Yeah. It's certainly a game that's got its rough edges, but it's charming as hell. And I think any little rough edges or pain points it has, I think are worth pushing through for the game that is here. I think there is a very creative game that has not felt too beholden to the things it's inspired by and has ideas of its own that it's putting effort into. And it's not just trying to be the joke, and it's not just trying to copy the thing that it's being compared to.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one of the biggest things, is this is a Souls-like that actually stands out. It's not an apocalyptic, medieval-like themed game. It's widened up a bit more now, but certainly when Souls-like as a genre was really taken off, everyone seemed to think that to be a Souls-like, you didn't just have to lift the framework of the gameplay. It had to be this dark, inhuman, medieval wasteland where all the enemies are hollow equivalents.
Yeah.
There's a little tiny bit of that in this, but it's just part of the story. Most of the crabs you're fighting are just the bosses are all sentient. They've all got their wits.
They're people that you know the motivations of, and you don't have to read a dozen item descriptions to understand why they want to fight you. And that's kind of refreshing sometimes.
Yeah, that is perfectly fine. I like that. But it is refreshing to play one where the world is alive. That little glimmer of life that's in Elden Ring was refreshing, but this is really what I like. The first boss is great when he's just, you violated the law! really over the top characters, it's great.
The bit that got me that made me think they've taken a very different approach to the world feeling alive was when you get to that town with two layers to it, where you have the upper crust and the sort of
the lower
dingier
crust.
Below. Yeah, the lower crust. And that town had a real personality. It had a lot of lived spaces. It had community, and you could see the divides that had built within it. But there was there was just people about living lives in a way that was, interesting to see away from where the fights were.
Plus, there's a major reward in the lower crust. Mm-hmm. There's the leg lamp. That was just sweet. I really like the locations. Visually, it's a very simple game, but it's got a lot of personality, which a lot of Souls-like games need.
Mm.
Unless it's really good, Lords of the Fallen, which was fucking great, despite the fact that it was everything I just criticized about Souls-likes following the leader a bit too much, but it was exceptional quality. Whereas this, quality-wise, I've made my feelings known, but in terms of just being just a delight, it's a little delight. It's a very good game, and it is different. Which is what the genre needs.
Exactly. Yeah. What about you, comrade? What you been playing this week?
I have been playing a Survivors game called Slime 3K. This is a follow-up on a game that I have played in the past called Despotism 3K. It's sort of a management sim where you have to produce humans and then get them to breed and produce more humans and keep them fed. And sometimes that means grinding up the humans and feeding them back to them, things like that. It's presented in this very minimalist stick figure character type of way with unsettling and weird animations, but not very high fidelity, I guess would probably be the way to put it. And despite having some really good sprite art, incredible sprite art, but most of what you're encountering are stick figures and stuff. So it's already primed for this type of game visually. You are a slime that accumulates items, weapons, and tries to survive to destroy the despot. And it's, I mean, it follows the formula for the most part, but there are a few things about it that I think are either interesting or good directions or just things to include in a game like this. The way your weapons and upgrades work, as you move around and kill enemies, occasionally a power-up will be created. These are things like increasing your speed temporarily, increasing your defense, giving you a shield, health pickups. One more that I'll get into in a second because it's a thing. And then shops will appear. And in the shops, when you arrive, you get an award of some coins that you can spend in it. The shop will have three items to choose from to start. And they're all made up of cards in a deck that you've built with your various equipment and items. And each of the cards comes in a different ranking, D through S. And at minimum, your deck has to have three of them so that you can't just build a hyper-focused deck and dominate. I don't know if you... Did you ever play Chocobo Racing?
Yeah.
Not the original. I played Chocobo GP, which was... very similar, but I never played the original one.
I did, yeah.
All right, so in Chocobo Racing, just like in a normal kart game, you'd get your power-ups. And in Chocobo Racing, they're all the spells in Final Fantasy games. And likewise, they have the levels. So you collect crystals along the cart path, and they're of a specific type. And if it's, fire... You get a fire one. If you get a second one, it becomes Fira. And if you get three, it becomes Firaga.
Yes.
Same deal here.
Mm.
The moment you said spells, for some reason, I was like, I hope Conrad says Firaga. I want to hear Conrad say Firaga.
Sometimes
I get strange desires, but I'm really glad. I couldn't ask you to do it either.
Sure.
It would have to be natural.
Right.
So,
right.
Oh, that's a hit of the good stuff.
Oh,
thank
good.
You, my man.
I'm so glad I could be of assistance there. So that's the way these work. If you collect three of them, they consolidate into one and become more powerful. And you can do this. You get three level one ones, they become a level two. You get three level two ones, they become a level three and become significantly more powerful. More importantly, though, they also then take up less space in your equipment bar. You can have up to 9 active items in your inventory. And then 4 that are inactive that are there to basically allow you to level up the other ones in your active selection without running out of space and having to sell out of things because there's just not enough room. So it's a good accommodation and makes it pretty flexible, but you still have to sort of pace yourself in terms of what things you collect and what you focus on developing out as you build up the abilities of your slime. Which I think is a pretty good move. Another thing that it does really well is it will all, if there is a power-up to be gotten, it is telling you where it is. If it's not on the screen, and there is a power-up of a type that is not on the screen, it will point an arrow towards where the closest one is. And this can be vital when you're dealing with a huge horde and you can't turn around and you desperately need health or armor, finding those is huge. But it's also good for just making general progress and keeping up on shops that you may have missed spawned or spawned at the load of the level. And you'll want to get over those because everything is about getting as many shops as possible, it seems like, in this. But the weapons are interesting. You have homing type weapons, you have direct fire ones that you'll use with your right analog to aim, or your mouse, I guess, if you're playing with a mouse and keyboard. You get your passive abilities that will improve all of those. And it just feels like there's a pretty good balance in terms of what's offered, how powerful it is. There's a piggy bank item that I find to be immensely useful, where as you build it up, it becomes more valuable for sale later. You upgrade the shop with some of these coins over time, increasing the number of items offered, as well as the percentage odds that you will get items of specific grades. So there's a bit of complexity wrapped up in this, which I really like. There's a few little things that are a bit frustrating. The most annoying bit is there is a type of power-up that is intended to be an area of effect attack, where when you move over it, your slime explodes out to a big radius, like three times normal, your size, doing damage to everything that's enveloped in it. And that's great. Like, it's cool to have a really powerful explosion thing that you can run over. The problem is the animation takes for fucking ever. And so by the time you have reformed and are able to move again, if you have shit chasing you, they're all over your ass now. And there's a period of invulnerability that you get to escape. But if you were fleeing from a horde of things that are firing projectiles at you, and you accidentally run into one of these, or it spawns immediately underneath you because you happen to kill a guy there, it will totally fuck your day up. And I find that just so frustrating. Drives me crazy. But at the same time, I can't knock it too much, because it does add an element of avoidance in power-up collection that's weirdly compelling. It's just annoying when you aren't given the opportunity to avoid it. But on the whole, this is a really well-presented, interesting Survivors game with a lot of flexibility and approach and some real strategy to it. The levels feel a little like they're geared towards specific strategy, at least in the early going. You know, eventually you will reach a point through purchasing upgrades that are carrying across to your slime as opposed to having to be acquired in the level. And that sort of eliminates a lot of that in the earlier stages, but I do still feel like there is something else that this game wants me to do to accomplish this ninth level that I'm just not quite landing on yet. But I do like the slime development upgrade path with all of the options. Everything is resettable at any given time to completely wipe the slate clean and rebuild, which is very convenient. The other issue I have is with how it manages menus. When you're playing the game, it is very considerate of the idea that you may have a second thought. Like, when you're in a shop and you're doing your buying stuff, sometimes you'll change your mind about, you know what, I do want to acquire that item, but I've already pressed the button to exit the shop. You have to hold it to exit the shop for a little while, and this can be a little bit funky when you're exiting, because the impulse is to immediately be moving as soon as you go, and if you move your analog before you've let go of the circle button, it resets the exit action, and so you have to do that again. That's a little bit annoying, but where I find it even worse is that because that's how you exit that shop, and that is one of the menu actions you perform the most frequently, it trains you to exit menus that way. Which, when you're in the deck menu, holding that button, that same button, wipes out your deck. And it's not their fault that I'm stupid necessarily, and I keep doing that even knowing that's what's going to happen. But I've become so used to exiting the most frequently used menu by this mechanic that my impulse is to apply it to other menus. That's a bit of a problem.
Yeah, I don't think we can attribute that to stupidity on your part if they're conditioning, like, muscle memory into your relationship with their menus. Then, yeah, it's on them to have a better level of consistency or better warning, like, signs before confirmation, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really what it needs in those non-gameplay menus where that's an issue, is to just have a confirmation there instead that you want to do it, that, you know, forces you to stop and be like, was this the action I intended? On the whole, the game is very good with, you know, just a few quality of life things that I would kind of like to see implemented. But in general, it's really attractive visually. It does play quite well, and there's some interesting strategic thought that goes into it. So I'm a fan. It is worth checking out. It's, you know, one of these $5-6 games. So Slime 3K, yeah, I would take a look if you like the visuals and so forth. It does play generally very well and a fun pace shift from some of the other Survivors games that are out there.
Nice. I've got one I can talk about this week, and it's going to take me very little fucking time to talk about. I played Stellar Blade.
This is a game I've heard talked about a lot by Chuds, I think.
People have tried to sucker punch it, where they've tried to hold it up as their antithesis to the woke agenda. I've played the demo of this, so I've certainly got at least some idea of the ballpark you've been playing in, but
yeah,
the demo didn't give me a terrible impression, but your tone suggests otherwise.
I don't have a terrible impression. I just have the kind of very middle of the road impression that it's one of these games where I know being middle of the road about is gonna, it, like, Chuds are gonna get angry about this one, but hey, you know that game you're holding up as the bastion of the anti-woke agenda, the future of video games, because you can take a lady robot and make it look kind of like she's naked? It's not a fucking good game. It's not great.
It never is.
It's not a great game.
The saddest thing about these games that are used, like, by them for their culture war is, it would be more interesting if the games they were holding up were either fucking excellent or fucking shit. Like, right. Really shit. But right. They always hold up the most mediocre, which I guess for them and their sort of uplifting of the most mediocre white men possible. Like, that's all their heroes are just these embodiments of mediocrity. And the games they hold up are so mundane.
To be specific about this one, in this one, the way they're holding it up is to go, well, white people are being too woke agenda about video games. We got to support this Korean game because they're not doing all this woke shit. That's their angle on this one. But here's the gist. This is a perfectly serviceable third-person action game, and I have some positive things to say about some of the accessibility stuff it's got going on. But it is also an incredibly fucking derivative experience that, in the amount of it I've played, and I'll get to why I haven't finished it yet shortly, just feels like it's riding on the coattails if it wants you to think it's Nier Automata, and it's not. And it's doing so little of its own that it really keeps inviting that comparison, and it doesn't come off well from that comparison.
I definitely picked up shades of that while playing the demo, where it's like, you can see they're trying to go for a little of that Nier flavor.
Yeah. And the problem is that they at least in, like, I'm going to say the first, like, 6 or 7 hours, are way too afraid to actually establish their own world building or any kind of core of their own. They are very light on telling you any plot, and what plot points they do hint at are just the fucking plot of Nier Automata. And when that's all you've got to kind of latch onto, it's hard not to go, this game plays alright, but it doesn't play as good as Nier Automata, which very few games do. It's not a particularly fair bar to hold this game to, but, like, I don't have anything actively bad to say about its combat. So, like, the plot of the opening hours really does boil down to, you are a robot being sent down to Earth. Earth has, is no longer really habitable by humanity because, you know, instead of big robots that you gotta fight this time, it's kind of fleshy aliens you gotta fight. Explore the ruins of an abandoned Earth that doesn't have humans, that only has robots that look like humans are here. There's fucking nothing of its own it's got in that regard. I won't deny that it is a visually pretty, pretty stunning game. Like, just from a sheer number of, like, visual effects being thrown at you, it's a very nice looking game.
I tell you what, about the visuals, I'm confused by them.
Mm.
Because I recognize that they are good. And
yes,
it is visually impressive, but for some reason, it all looks cheap to me. And I'm not sure why. It must be something about the visual style, because graphically it is fine.
I can point out to you a moment that keeps sticking in my head as where the visuals felt cheap, and it's that they don't feel cohesive to other elements. Ooh. And the moment that made me think that was right at the start of the game when you first come out your little drop pod, and I watched a humanoid-faced character talk with a British accent that did not feel like it was connected to the character model.
Yeah.
The thing was, is I was like, that's a good-looking character model, that's a good-sounding voice. The two of them don't sound like they were designed in parallel.
There is something a bit assety about it. And I'm not saying that's what's going on, but...
No.
You're right, the artistic clash is there.
There's lots of moments like that, where it's like, these things, by themselves, are well-made, but it feels like you pushed them together in ways that just don't quite click naturally.
I tell you another thing I think might be going on is the character proportions have that sort of knockoff Bayonetta vibe that I've seen in cheapo Steam ripoff games.
And again, I wanted to, like, the three things I kept sort of trying to compare this to in my head is I wanted to compare it to, like, Nier Automata, Bayonetta, and, like, a Devil May Cry. And, like, it doesn't stand up well mechanically to that sort of Nier Automata world-building or mechanical comparison, but when you compare it to something like a Bayonetta or a Devil May Cry, it feels like it's lacking that sense of visual stylization, where it's like, we're coming up with creative things to do with that visual flair. It feels like it's lacking that exaggerated over-the-topness that, like, a lot of things will layer on top of that kind of art style. It's lacking a lot of the things that would elevate this into a direction. I do want to say there are some positive things to say about the accessibility stuff with the game. I appreciate that high contrast mode is present. I like that there is some stuff there for combat accessibility. I don't like that the combat assist mode, that I'll talk about in a second, is limited to playing on story mode, because I don't like having to play on a lower enemy difficulty in order to get access to this. But there's a nice option that is offered for any time a big enemy is coming in with an attack that you would need to parry or dodge, you can get a prompt on screen and a short timer to press the button and do that action that would otherwise have been a very short frame window. It takes some getting used to, because if you're button mashing in combat and that, like, prompt and timer comes up and you press a button that isn't that one, the prompt goes away and you've missed your opportunity, which kind of forces you to play a little bit less button mashy, which maybe isn't a bad thing, but other games that have introduced similar kinds of accessibility features give, like, a little window of grace of inputs in the first, like, little moment when something like that comes up to not miss your opportunity to interact with it. So not perfect there. I do appreciate that when you have to find, like, codes in the environment written in sort of Greek symbols and then go type them in at a keypad, if, like me, you struggle with visual memory and recall, there is the ability to turn on hints where it will just show you that code you saw so you can type it in without having to try and remember what it was you saw a minute ago. Really appreciate that, personally. The reason I haven't played more of it, and for all I know it becomes a Game of the Year contender halfway in or whatever, the reason I haven't played more of it is this is a third-person game that, over multiple play sessions over multiple days, routinely made me really motion sick. And that usually doesn't happen with third-person games. And I'm really struggling to identify what this game is doing that is causing it, because, like, I've ruled out the usual suspects of, you know, I'm playing it when I'm a little too tired, or I'm not, you know, playing it in a poorly lit room at the wrong distance from the screen. And the game does have options to mitigate motion sickness, which suggests they know it's an issue. It's got options that I often don't see outside of first-person games. But even with those tweaked, I couldn't play for very long without motion sickness setting in a way that was really disorienting. It's something weird about this game I haven't been able to nail down, and it's prevented me getting further into it.
Interesting.
Yeah. But yeah, general thoughts. It's not a bad game. It's just a game that feels unconnected between its various parts and that keeps inviting me to compare it to better things and that is afraid to establish much of its own identity in its opening hours, much yeah. to its own detriment.
It feels like it's gonna be... I mean, I'm sort of... I wouldn't say looking forward to it, but, like, it's my kind of thing. Yeah. And it doesn't... Based on the demo, I'm not going to have a bad time with it.
No.
But it really is the same track as the fucking Wizard game and fucking Hatred way back in the day, where it's like, at best, it's okay, and it's mostly meh, and they're treating it like a cultural revolution because they can't achieve higher than pedestrian.
The way I would describe it is, if not for the motion sickness, I probably would play this start to finish and go, that was a time I had. Because of the motion sickness issues this game is weirdly giving me, I don't think it's good enough that I want to push through feeling ill to see it through. It's not a good enough game that I'm going to put up with being ill to play it. None of its positives are positive enough to outweigh the difficulty I'm having with it mechanically. So, more power to anyone who enjoys it. It's feeling very mediocre to me. What about you, Steph? You played anything else this week?
I played some other stuff. I forgot to note one on our pre-show list of games we played. So I wrote down Fallout 4, which I've been playing, but fuck that. Because I just remembered another underwater-themed game that I played this past week that needs to be talked about, because it's one of these things where everyone's talking about it, but nobody's talking about it. I've not seen it brought up too many places, but whenever I tell anyone I'm playing it, they're like, I've been hearing about that. And it's called Harold Halibut.
I've seen this, and I haven't had a chance to check it out.
Yeah, you see, it's a lot of people have all heard it.
Yeah, I saw it on Game Pass, but I haven't, like, checked it out. Yeah.
Check it out.
Okay.
Do check it out. It's interesting. I've not yet seen what about it has had some people, like, with their jaws on the floor. This is brilliant. But I've bought into it. Like, I'm all in on it. So it's a point-and-click style adventure game. There's not really puzzles or anything. It's a lot of, like, walking and talking with some, like, little bits of busy work. It's slow. It's not necessarily a bad thing for this kind of game, but there are points where I'm like, get to the point. Like, we've belabored this enough. But it is about this handyman lab assistant on a spaceship that is crash-landed in an alien ocean, and it did that hundreds of years ago when it was sent off of the planet Earth, which was on, like, during a really heating up Cold War, and they thought, like, the apocalypse was coming, so they sent this ship out to look for a new world. It crashed, and they've just been down there for generations. And then weird shit happens. They find some weird sample and possibly a chance to actually get off-world or find some way to, you know, at least get out of the ocean. Early on, a fish flies past a window with an airplane style banner that just says we're free out here, and that sort of sets the tone for this sort of strange thing going on underneath the surface. And I've played for many, many hours, and I'm still trying to see what's beneath the surface. A big interesting thing has happened, but it's not really reached any sort of crescendo or major development. I'm trying to avoid spoilers, so some of this sounds a bit useless. But it will take a plot point and then just spend a bit too long on it. I guess that's the best way to say it. However, it looks fucking visually impressive as hell, because it is all entirely stop motion.
Mm.
I believe animated by hand in that regard.
I believe that is correct. It is the main thing I knew about it in advance was... That sure is a visually impressive art thing you did.
The smoothness. The frame rate of the stop motion is fucking impressive. The one-to-one control of it and the associated smoothness, really good. The writing is, like I say, despite how slow and sometimes I feel dragged out it is, the writing is still such that I am on board. I like the characters. I like the very unsubtle stuff about capitalism and what happens when corporations sort of govern, like have total say over a society's direction. So that's all really interesting. The main character I didn't like at first is a bit fucking whiny, but over time you do sort of enjoy him. There is a fantastic Big Lebowski reference. It's so fucking good. I absolutely love it, but there is an entertainer who is on a stage, and it's, as soon as I worked out what was happening, I was so delighted. I've been trying not to say charming too much lately because I do use that word a lot, but this is, it's nice, and there is a coziness to it. It's one of these ones where I struggle to start playing it, where I'm like, do I really want to just sit down and experience that right now? But as soon as I do start, I'm in, like I'm locked in. And especially if it's on Game Pass, I would recommend people check it out. I am really looking forward to seeing where it's going. It has maintained my interest even at its slowest moments because I want to know where it's going. And there's some good jokes in there as well and some really fun stuff. And yeah, visually fucking incredible. There's some strange visual glitches, I guess. I don't even know if it's a glitch, it's more of like an oversight. There is a lot of times where they need to animate Harold getting into place to talk or interact with someone, which will lead to some awkward character sliding or just taking too long to get into position. Or one of the most frequent is if there's an object in front of him, like if you, at night when you send him to bed, he will, in order to get into the right position to perform the get into bed animation, he first has to clip through the bed every single time. So he's like stood in the middle of the bed and then slides out of it and then does getting into bed. And it happens every time, and it sort of can be quite illusion breaking. Like it breaks kayfabe. And that is a bit of a frequent thing. But other than that, and some of the back and forth thing, like there is a lot of just walking back and forth from A to B and using these water based elevators that are conceptually great, but you use them so many times and the elevator announcements are the same, so it gets a bit dull. But it's one of those games where every time I would say something negative, it is immediately followed by but. Overall, well worth checking out. I'm looking forward to getting back on it when we're done here, really.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
You played anything else, Conrad?
No, I don't think so. You mentioned Fallout, and you know, I assume because you watched the show, Steph, that you felt a compulsion, as have many, it seems,
I mean,
to go back.
Yeah, it's a couple things. There's a Fallout project happening at the moment, locally, and so it's been on my mind. The TV show has been on my mind. Again, I have to reiterate, what a great fucking show.
I'm three what episodes in show. And pretty impressed.
Mate, it's got Walton Goggins in it.
He's very entertaining.
I love Walton Goggins. They made him convincingly handsome at the start.
Mm.
I mean, Jesus, he's got that Rowan Atkinson thing going on where he can look fucking hideous or fucking dashing without even changing his appearance, just his manner.
Yeah,
great.
Yeah.
But yes, I've had it on my mind. I actually was rewatching the old H Bomber Guy videos as well, the Fallout 3's garbage and the New Vegas is genius one, and that really got me. So I've just been very Fallout centric. Mm-hmm. So I was like, yeah, fuck it, let's get playing again. I've been tempted to get cracking on, because I started a New Vegas file last year or the year before. I was really into it.
New Vegas is the one out of all of them that I know is so much better than all the others, but I never make it past the point of setting up the mods.
Yeah. Oh, that is a shame.
I don't know what it is. Like, I have played it through before. You know, I finished it at some point. Yeah, I did complete it, but every time I go back to it, it's, you know, 4 hours of setting up mods and then being like, now I don't want to play the game. The one I am itching to kind of replay, and this is just me being the filthiest, dirtiest boy. I'm itching to play Brotherhood of Steel again.
Brotherhood of Steel. Oh my god, is that the like Diablo-y kind of? Yes. I have. That was my first exposure to Fallout.
Oh my god!
I never
god.
Played it. I didn't play it, but I saw all these trailers for this game that I hadn't really heard of because I just wasn't following that area of games. So I'd never really heard of Fallout, but I saw this game called Brotherhood of Steel, and I really liked Baldur's Gate Dark Alliance at the time, so I was like, ooh. And then just, like, many games at that period where I was fucking poor, and I thought, ooh, about something, I never played it again. Well, I mean, I never played it at all.
Well,
I've heard it's not great.
Oh, God, no, it's... So my logic behind this is twofold. One, it's a cooperative game, so I can play it with Linda. But also, Linda like is conscious of Fallout and maybe played a little bit of the original one like 20-odd years ago. But her like knowledge of the lore and setting and all of that is generally pretty sparse. She's about as close to someone not being familiar with Fallout as possible. And so I'm running a little experiment, you know, give them the best possible introduction to the setting in the show, and then give them the most disrespectful of the lore entry in the franchise as basis of comparison. Because it is truly, like, it does not give a fuck how much you like Fallout and how seriously you take Fallout. It's happy to shit all over all of it.
And that actually sounds brilliant.
It's pretty great. It's like if the people who made Fallout were like, oh, no, these cool, smart, intelligent things, that these were never the intent. Oh, God, we better overcorrect. It's so bad. You get a bazooka that fires meat by the end of it.
You're doing nothing but sell this to me.
I know.
What was this? Xbox, PS2? Yeah. I could probably get this on the Steam Deck.
Yeah, emulated, maybe.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's what I mean.
Because this is one that that Interplay pretended didn't exist shortly after release, and I'm sure Bethesda would pretend that they don't have it if they knew. And I'm not sure they know.
Yeah, the only thing that's on Steam is Fallout Tactics Brotherhood of Steel, which I'm assuming is different.
Yeah, that's a tactics-based game, which I've never played, but I've heard is good, just tactics aren't my thing. But yeah, it's Xbox and PS2. I remember the Xbox version being a little bit better, but I don't know how easy that is to emulate in comparison to PS2, which is very easy to emulate. I think I have a physical copy for the Xbox. But yeah, I'm very excited to play it again because it is trash.
There was going to be a sequel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There was moral choice. Good and evil. 10 new enemies.
Oh boy. Right?
Ten whole new enemies. Ooh. A brand new sneaking system. Oh god. You'd have been able to sneak.
Oh god.
Or use a sniper rifle even. And there was a turret mode for the characters that couldn't use sniper rifles, but the first game sold for shit.
Yes, it did.
So, yes. They started making it before they finished making the first one. And that, its development caused the cancellation of Black Isle Studios' Fallout 3. So, that's the legacy Brotherhood of Steel left behind after its disrespect. It also killed Fallout 3.
It destroyed Van Buren. Yeah, that's pretty remarkable. So worth a look. If you are a fan of Fallout and are down to be just disrespected in the most brutal fashion possible, you can't do better than Fallout Brotherhood of Steel.
I'm excited.
Yeah.
The only other thing I've played, and like this can be real quick, but I'm still playing Balatro because that has been my travel game because I was at GA Conf, the big game accessibility conference, the last couple of days, and I needed something to play on the road. I've been having fun with the Ghost Deck, which is one that I hadn't really put as much time into as I wanted to, which gives you the spectral packs and spectral cards a lot more mm-hmm. often, and starts you off with a spectral card that will turn one of your jokers into having a 1.5 times multiplier applied to it. It's a really nice one for generating a good start, and I found that you can quite often line it up so that, like, your very first joker gets that 1.5 times multiplier applied to it, and you can get the spectral card that's like, hey, duplicate one of your jokers and delete all the rest. Mm-hmm. It's cool, I only have one. To have two of the same good starting joker that both have 1.5 times multiplier on them.
Yeah.
And that's a fun one to play around with. The one that's maybe more interesting, that, like, I didn't play around with the deck because A, I'd never been told I needed to unlock anything else, and B, I misunderstood the description of how the deck worked, was the Plasma deck.
Yes, the Plasma deck is insane.
Yeah, because the way the Plasma deck is described, I thought I needed to play hands of cards that would result in a balance of, like, the number of chips and the number of multipliers would be very close to each other.
No, no.
To get a bonus.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, no, no. That is not a well-written description. I understand now. Mm-hmm. Whatever your chips are and whatever your multiplier are, those numbers are just
average.
Mushed together into one pile and averaged out. Mm-hmm. So if you go wildly high on chips, because chips are really, like, because we're dealing with much larger numbers, it's much easier to get bigger numbers on your chip modifier.
Right.
You can use that to vicariously raise up your overall multiplier for your hand really high. Mm-hmm. And it leads to lots and lots of playing things like every time you play a card, the number of chips it's worth permanently increases. Or every time you play a hand of exactly four cards, this joker will be worth more chips. Or the amount of money you have in your hand converts into chip value. And all these things that by themselves can almost negate the need to think at all about the multipliers. It's a weirdly fun deck, and one that, like, I'm glad I got around to trying, because I'd just gotten the wrong idea in my head and thought it was going to require a lot more fiddliness from me rather than just, no, make infinite chips. So yeah, that's my Bellatro update. Should we talk about some newsy bits?
Let's do it.
What do we got on the newsy stuff this week? This one's kind of interesting, in terms of, like, UK video game convention stuff. So there are two, I would argue, like, big conventions that happen in the UK. There is MCM Comic Con, which is theoretically a fairly broad pop culture nerdy convention, and there is EGX, which is the big video game convention-y event. And both of these events have been kind of struggling for several years. MCM, many years ago, used to have quite a big video game presence, which has very much shrunk over the years. And EGX has, like, struggled to find a social element outside of having games there. It seems like, because they're both owned by ReedPop, that owns, like, places like Eurogamer, they're kind of just becoming one event, which is weird because that's kind of what MCM used to be. It seems like starting from October this year, both events will be happening in the same venue on the same weekend, with one ticket getting you into both. Which, for these two, basically the only two, like, really big convention events that happen in the UK, hopefully that's healthy for them, because both of those events have been in a weird place recently. Not going to be of much interest to people outside of the UK, but it's worth knowing, because, like, ReedPop, as, like, event organizers, have been in a weird place. They bought E3, they sold E3 off before ever running an E3. They have seemed to not be sure what they're doing with any of their convention brands. And the answer seems to be just kind of run two of them at once and hope that's enough for people to want to go.
I mean, COVID fucked them. Like, not to have sympathy for an organization that gobbled up every consumer, you know, entertainment show under the sun.
I mean, COVID fucked them is definitely part of it, but, like, from the outside, MCM has gotten more and more, like, since Reed Pop acquired it, it's gotten more and more here are things to buy and less here are things to do. And EGX has... when I started going to EGX like a decade ago, you used to reliably have Nintendo, PlayStation, and Xbox present.
Sure.
And one by one, they the big three have been falling away from EGX.
Well,
like,
but that's the same with E3, you know, all of these shows. Yeah. They know that they could do it better themselves and not have to spend the outlay.
Indeed. It's just one of those things where it's like, there's been a whole batch of stuff going on, and hopefully this gets them back up and on their feet a bit.
I think that that's why the organizations that previously managed these were happy to sell.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, they saw the writing on the wall, and Reed Pop, likewise, you know, probably looked at it and thought, well, we could do better by consolidating these shows. We can run them more cost-effectively, and we'll make money off of them. And that has, you know, that may not be the case. It may not have worked out that way, because they... perhaps misjudged the value that those other companies were bringing.
Mm. Yeah, we'll see. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to see what that ends up leading to. In other news, there was a rumor a while back that you know, Fortnite, it's got characters from fucking everything in it. It's had I believe it's had Kratos from God of War as being in it, and I think they've had some Xbox characters as well. And around the time that was happening, people were going, oh, are we going to get a Nintendo character as well? And the rumors were doing the rounds that Samus from Metroid was going to be in Fortnite. And then nothing ever really happened of that. We now actually know some insight into what was going on there via some insight from Donald Mustard, who used to be in charge of Fortnite. That was a real thing. They did want to get Samus into Fortnite, and it didn't happen because Nintendo apparently got real, real hung up on the idea that their characters would appear on other people's consoles, and that they didn't like that at all.
That's not surprising. That sounds right. Yeah, that's pretty Nintendo.
Yeah, so just confirming, it was Master Chief and Kratos were the two Xbox and PlayStation characters, and yeah, with those, you could play as those characters on other consoles, including on Switch. You could play as Kratos and Master Chief on Switch, but Nintendo was like, yeah, we'll do it if you agree to not make the skin visible to people on other platforms. So if you're playing on Switch, you can see people are playing as Samus, but like if you're playing on PlayStation, you'll see some other skin instead of seeing that they're being Samus.
Oh.
Yeah, that was their solution, was we'll do it if the skin is only visible to Switch players and everyone else sees something generic.
That kind of runs counter to the whole sort of philosophy.
Right.
That is weird. It reminds me of Soul Calibur 2, I think it was.
Yes.
Where they put out separate versions for all of the platforms with their own unique character on it.
But, like, that's less weird when cross-play existing is what makes that weird.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's weird to me as well, given that Nintendo has Smash Brothers and clearly understands making deals with other companies to go, your property being in our game would be a mutually beneficial marketing exercise to some degree, and that we can probably make a deal to make that worthwhile for both parties, that they couldn't see the same being valuable to put Samus in front of people on other platforms.
It is interesting, the sort of walled garden of their intellectual property that they maintain. And I honestly can't fault them for it, because it has been incredibly effective, and they have truly managed to maintain a level of quality control. Like, we haven't seen a CDI game since, right?
Mm.
Like, we haven't seen anything on the level of Wand of Gamelon in 25 years.
Yeah.
And that's remarkable.
Yeah, that's what you manage by keeping an iron grip on your property.
Right, like, say what you will about some of the games that have come along. You know, there are ones that we all have little criticisms about here and there. The Princess Peach Showtime just came out, and it's fine. It's not mind-blowing, but it's fine. But you never see anything on the level of a dog shit game with one of their properties touching it at all. It just doesn't happen.
And also, to be fair, if there's one crossover I wouldn't want Nintendo properties to be in if I'm Nintendo, it's probably Fortnite, because Fortnite is more than once with its create your own levels and create your own mode stuff, had like people have made pretty fucking risque content that has taken some time to be moderated, and I can understand Nintendo being terrified of the idea of Samus Aran shows up in the We Hate Minorities map that someone makes in Fortnite.
The only worst place for them to be would be Roblox.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. You know how Embracer bought up all those studios and then sold them all off and caused all sorts of chaos for the industry?
I do recall.
Yep.
Well, you know, they're everything's clearly better now, because they're splitting themselves up into some smaller sub-teams within Embracer, and two-thirds of them have the words "and friends" in their names, so clearly they're nice now.
It worked for Garfield. That revitalized his career. He owes a lot to that pig.
He does. Yeah, he does. That pig ruled.
Garfield and Friends was a good fucking show.
Yes. This is interesting, the "and friends" thing, because, you know, they're clearly, by doing that, sort of centering around one studio in their collection and sort of accumulating around that. So that they're putting their focus on one thing, whether from a marketing purpose or production standpoint.
Yeah.
And that's interesting. The other one, though, is Asmodee. That's the one that I find really interesting. Asmodee was itself one of these companies that gobbled up and gobbled up and gobbled up. They just did it more in the tabletop space.
Yeah.
And the acquisition of them by Embracer, I was genuinely very surprised by, because it was such a huge buy. It was such a huge consolidation. Yeah. And it makes sense to me that they would spin that back out into its own organization. But what I find really interesting about it is that they have put all the debt on Asmodee.
Yes.
All of the debt that was accrued through these acquisitions has been placed on them, and they're going to be spun out to be an independent, completely independent organization within a couple of years.
And I'll say this. Asmodee is probably the predictable one of these, because their tabletop game adaptation to video game stuff is pretty predictable in terms of quality and the audience size that exists for it. If you're gonna put the debt somewhere, it's maybe the place you can have a better prediction of how it's gonna pan out.
But it's also the place that you're planning to divest yourself of within a few years, so...
Yeah.
Like, not to say that I think that they're burying Asmodee. I do think that it's the probably of what they have, the one that has the best chance of being able to turn that around and become profitable, simply because of all of the licensing arrangements, and the sales are good for their products. Like, they were making money. It wasn't like they were irresponsibly acquiring, as everyone was, I think, but not to the extent that Embracer was, and maybe they can turn that around, but it'll be a really interesting thing to see play out.
Yeah. The other thing that's interesting, because the other two branches they've split them into, like, you could basically go, this is the big budget studios and this is the indie ones, but it's Middle Earth Enterprises and Friends, which is all of their, like, you know, Crystal Dynamics, Eidos Montreal, Deep Silver, all of that stuff. I feel like putting, like, Lord of the Rings in the name of this, it feels like it's signaling, hey, we don't care what you were making before, we're really going to go all in on this one property we own and probably put a lot of you on making stuff for it.
I do wonder if it's more about signaling to investors and consumers that they're going to be putting a focus on what is, no doubt, the most powerful IP in their repertoire. I think it's probably, like, these names are going to change. These are temporary names.
Yeah.
They're going to come up with something else. But I think that, it's more signaling that they have a commitment to this incredibly popular IP that they're going to exploit. And if you're going to apply that to anything, you want to put it on your, this is our flagship AAA shit. So,
yeah. The other one is Coffee Stain and Friends. And that is, you know, Coffee Stain, which does Goat Simulator, Valheim. Ghost Ship Games, which does Deep Rock Galactic, and that's the one where I'm like, please don't fucking break that studio. They're so good with such a healthy, sensible business model and monetization. Basically, all of their like mid-size indie and free-to-play stuff. The fact that they put the Anne Friends... I know it's easy to rag on the Anne Friends thing, but the fact they put it on two of their three teams really does feel like they're trying to be like, no, we're a family, you're safe from the layoffs, you're the ones that are family and friends, we love you, please don't fear for your careers here. It really does feel like they're trying to soften everything they've done to the industry a little.
Yeah, probably a little bit. I mean, yeah, I don't think anybody working for them has any fucking illusions at this point. They've all been living in a state of terror similar to the Stalinist purges for a couple years now.
Yeah. Other than that, we got one nice little quick story. World of Warcraft finally has an arachnophobia mode.
Good.
Which is pretty good. People have been asking for it for a while. The reason why now? They're introducing a race of spider people to the game.
There you go.
Like an entire race of spider people, and they were like, okay, it's probably a good opportunity for us to do something about the people who are afraid of spiders. It'll apply to the spider mode, the new spider race, but it will also apply to spiders generally. They're, I believe, all being turned into pink crabs.
That's better. Sorry, why the fuck do we have a race of spider people and not a race of... I mean, I'm putting on arachnophobia mode if I ever play this.
Yeah, that's
I'm not going to. But pink crab people, yes,
pink
please.
Pink crab people!
It's better than my idea. I was sat here thinking, how do you make an entire race of spider people palatable in that way? And the best I could think of was putting corks on the end of their legs like pirate... like when a pirate goes to sleep in a cartoon... I don't know what that would achieve.
My answer to it is replace them with just, like, regular humans, because that wouldn't be particularly funny for the spider race, but for the actual spider enemies that crawl around on the floor, I'm just imagining a person on their hands and feet scuttling.
Oh, little Jonathan Holmes is just scuttling about.
Yeah, little Jonathan Holmes is scuttling about.
Oh, amazing.
I like the sort of role-playing opportunities that it presents. Like, holy shit, did you see that fucking spider? What spider? I see a giant crab.
Oh my god. God, the spirit of Kanan Lynch's multiplayer will live on.
And lastly, I forgot to do this last week, but I got those video game drinks. I'm still trying to work my way through to... Tetris will be next week, but I'm finding out what Spyro tastes like today.
All right, let's do
Lovely.
Let's give it a go. Hopefully it's less than watered down appetizer.
I'm assuming grape.
It is grape. Mm-hmm. But you know what threw me for like half a second is as I went to sip it, I realized it's called dragon fruit. Which dragon fruit's already a fruit.
Yeah.
It's called dragon fruit, but it does not taste of dragon fruit. It is very clearly grape.
Amazing.
Sorry. I did not pre-prepare for this. It is dragon fruit, grape flavor dragon fruit drink.
Wow. Fantastic.
It's at least not watered down this time. That's Spyro for you. I think we're done.
Oh.
sounds good. Well, before we drag on this any further, Laura, what else have you done, please, that we can hear about?
You can find all my stuff at Laura K Buzz pretty much everywhere on the internet. Laura K Buzz on Twitter, Twitch, YouTube, TikTok, Patreon. That's the one that pays the bills as little as $1 a month. Allows me to keep doing all the stuff I do. Blue Sky, Mastodon, all the stuff. There will be accessibility reviews of both Stellar Blade and Another Crab's Treasure up on youtube.com/LauraKBuzz. Those will both be up by the time that you hear this. One of them I published during the episode and one I'm publishing in like 20 minutes. Also, by the time you hear this, there will be an episode zero for a new video podcast I am doing called Control Alt Access, which will be myself and another creator called Arevia, who we're both people in the video game accessibility space, once every 2 weeks or so doing news and video game discussion very specifically focused on accessibility stuff. The kind of thing that, you know, I already do on accessibility, but with another person having conversations, because I like talking about accessibility and having other people's perspectives, and I found someone that's very fun to have accessibility chats with. There will be a little episode zero up that's basically there to go, hey, we needed to make podcast feeds, and those take a while to propagate, so enjoy meeting us and who we are. Next week we'll be starting the show proper with a full hour episode. We've also got a video from GAConf that we recorded live at the event that'll be going up the week after, so start looking out for Control Alt Access as an audio and visual podcast wherever you happen to find podcasts. What about you, Conrad? Where are you on the internet?
Oh, you can find me at Conrad Zimmerman on Instagram and Blue Sky. You can hang out with me on Twitch at twitch.tv/thatconradzimmerman. Been playing a lot of Spelunky 2 there lately. It just seems to be the thing. I can't seem to come up with anything else I'd rather do. So, but generally, that's a pretty good time. You get to watch me die in a variety of unexpected and embarrassing ways. It's a good time. You can buy anti-capitalist propaganda from me at mercenarycreative.com. Also got Jimquisition merchandise there. Get your gays can do whatever they want shirts ahead of Pride coming up. Get them bought. You can listen to me on Let's Talk About Snacks, where I talk about snacks, and go check out Red Planet, which is a podcast that I produce about how we can make the world a better place together. And everything that I do online gets supported through Patreon at patreon.com/fistshark. And you know who else has a Patreon? Stephanie Sterling.
That is correct. patreon.com/jimquisition. Also, I will be back in wrestling next week. Very excited. I was going to do the Eric Bischoff thing, but I pressed play and nothing happened. There it is. Right, well, fuck that, ruined it now. May 5th, next week. If you can get there, please do. I want a big turnout for this one. I've been rallying the Sterling section because I want to make a big debut. Well, re-debut, I suppose. I will be at Tidal Wrestling. That will be in Huddersfield, May 5th at Parish. There will be a discount code for those who are coming to say yes, Commander. If you order the tickets, look up Tidal Wrestling and use the code Parish Revenge. That'll get you a discount. It's going to be cool. At the time of talking, it's not been announced, but I will be in a tag match. And it's going to be good. This will be my first time in the ring since January. And then on May 9th, on the Thursday, I will be back in Leeds, back in Commander Country for True Grit Wrestling at True Grit. At True Grit Wrestle, pretty much everywhere on social, to get ticket information for that. And we'll have more dates announced in future. But I'm very excited about that. If you can get to Huddersfield, do come along. It will be good, and I will be hanging around in the bar downstairs because it's a really good bar that I like hanging out at. So yes, that's that. Thank you all so much for supporting this, that, and the other. And we will see you next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.